Welcome to the Soft Focus podcast. I'm so happy you're here. My name is Corinne McAndrews, and I am a farmer and the founder of Late Bloomer Ranch. Several years ago, I started to notice that my farm thrived when I took a step back and started to embrace a more holistic worldview. I began to realize my farm was more than just transactions or dollar signs. It was a seemingly magical place with so much happening that I couldn't fully understand it. This led me to embrace complexity and begin to see the beauty in things even when they seem difficult. I started to understand the power of the idea that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and that by acting from a heart-centered place, we can accept the complexity of things and act in the best interest of the larger puzzle. I want to explore that and talk with other people across disciplines who are viewing the world that way and are looking for those very same connections, because that, I feel, provides peace, humility, and compassion, things that the world could use a lot more of today. I need to be constantly reminded of my important but small role in this bigger cycle. Thank you for being here and for joining me. Welcome back to the podcast. Today's guest is Ellen Frost. She is the owner and floral designer behind Local Color Flowers in Baltimore, Maryland. And she spent the past 16 years building that business. It started as a passion and a hobby, just something fun on the side, helping friends plan weddings with exclusively local flowers. And since then, it's morphed into not only a brick and mortar design studio, but also a huge online platform with educational opportunities and a really groovy weekly newsletter, which she'll tell you all about in the episode. I loved talking to Ellen. I was inspired by her story, by the time that she took to build her vision, how she sees the long game. She talks about that a little bit, how she really looks at her business as a series of relationships that she's built over time, and how she had to create a supply chain from nothing. And through that, there were trials and tribulations and scaling up, scaling back, so many things that small scale businesses deal with, trying to find that right sized approach that works for the entrepreneur themselves and their skill set, etc. And for everyone who's interested in flowers specifically, Ellen is a wealth of knowledge. She talks about the differences between the commercial flowers that are imported from all over the world and what you may have access to in your local community, and why local flowers often seem like a pricing black box. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation, and I think it's one I'll come back to again and again for inspiration as we grow and scale our business here at Late Bloomer Ranch. And for those who are interested, here at Late Bloomer, we do have some new bloom boxes up on the website for our spring restock. Go ahead and check those out, and we'll be launching some new flower essences this spring as well, in addition to the ones that we currently have on the site. So if you haven't had a chance already to peruse what we're doing, please do. And if you're local to the Tetons, there's still time to get into our flower subscription, which runs June through September this year. So without any further ado, please enjoy Ellen Frost and her magical journey from Local Color Flowers in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Ellen. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I just want to start with the obvious question, which is, why local flowers?
Yeah, that's a good place to start. For me, when I started, I have a flower business called Local Color Flowers. And when I thought about starting a flower business, I intended to start it just with local flowers. So I wasn't a florist who did traditionally sourced flowers first and then switched to local or eased my way into local. I really started with the idea that I could start a business based entirely on local flowers. And for me, the reasoning behind it was I was trying to find a more sustainable, more community-focused alternative to traditionally sourced flowers. So I was of the age when a lot of people around me were getting married, and they were people who in Baltimore cared about buying local, and they cared about having a smaller footprint at their wedding. They went to the farmer's market. You know, they were sort of connected to the local economy and local growers, but there really wasn't a product for them to use for their wedding unless they just like showed up at the farmer's market on the morning of their wedding. So I really thought that I could be sort of a bridge between growers in our region who had really amazing, beautiful, sustainable flowers and consumers, at that time, mostly couples that were getting married and wanted to have sort of a more sustainable option. I thought I could be the bridge between them. So for me, it started really with sustainability and environmental issues and supporting a community of growers that we already had here that made sense to support.
So were you working in the floral industry before that? Or was it just sort of a fun hobby that you just felt drawn to it?
Yeah, it was just a hobby. My background is in affordable housing development. So I worked in commercial construction while I was starting this business. I sort of had a hobby of gardening, and I got a job working at a farm here in Baltimore County. And part of that job was working at the farmer's market. And so I met other farmers. I was taking the master gardening classes. My friends were doing it. So it was just all for fun. And then when people started getting married, we were like, my friends and I, you know, would say, oh, well, we know these farmers, they have flowers, let's design them for you. And, you know, that really just meant like putting flowers in a mason jar. So yes, totally started as a hobby. I had no background in floristry, gardening, flowers, art, color, anything. I studied political science in college. I studied Spanish. I worked in affordable housing. I had no background in flowers.
Wow, that's amazing. And I mean, since then, obviously the position of farmer florist has come to be a thing. But I'm guessing that even in the last 5 years, that whole role has blown up. But before that, there was obviously a big need for someone to bridge the gap in maybe what I'm hearing you say, correct me if I'm wrong, is like almost lower budget settings, where now, of course, local flowers at weddings can be very niche and involved and grandiose. I mean, what was it like not only building a business, but learning the wedding industry in the moment? This amazing story.
I went into it very naively. I don't know if I have to say that. Like, I just didn't know anything about the wedding industry or flowers. In the 16 years I've been in business, we've never had a minimum for wedding flowers. So my intention was always to make local flowers available to anybody at any budget. I really wanted people who cared about local flowers to be able to use them at their wedding, whether that meant they were having, you know, a very small wedding or a huge wedding. I really did not want, even though people said like you have to have a minimum, you're going to just keep getting all these small weddings and low budgets. And to me, it wasn't about that. It was about connecting people who cared about local flowers with local flowers, whatever their budget was. You know, I spent a lot of years doing sort of budget weddings that were in the $1,000 to $2,000 range. And I loved that. And I still love that. To me, there was a sort of fork in the road. Like my friend, I don't know if you know Jenny Love from Love and Fresh Flowers. She and I started around the same time, and our businesses have sort of grown up together. And we both sort of came to a point in the road where we said, okay, what happens next? Like, are we just going to keep doing a million small weddings, or is something going to change? And for Jenny, she sort of went the route of, no, I'm going to have a higher minimum. I'm really going to make this a luxury product. I'm really going to go less weddings, bigger budgets. And partly, I think it's probably our community here in Baltimore too, that I really wanted to stick with smaller weddings. And like I said, it was never driven by the budget. It was always driven by people's interest in local flowers. So I just tried to keep it that way. We have done big weddings, $10,000, $15,000 range. You know, we've done those weddings. But, you know, our sweet spot is like $4,000, $4,000 to $5,000, even less than that. And we do weddings at, you know, $500 still. It just really depends on what people, how much they care about local stuff. And we always tell people, because it's local doesn't mean it's cheap. Local flowers are more expensive than cheap commodity flowers that you buy at the grocery store or even at the wholesaler. So we are, you know, sort of constantly educating people about how the flower industry works and why local flowers are more expensive, but also why they are awesome and why they're a great option in almost all cases.
Tell me more about that. That was my next question, especially with these smaller budget weddings, like we've done some elopements, et cetera. And when working direct with a client, you know, the pricing structure is a little bit different for you when you're negotiating between small farms who were your inspiration for starting this business in the first place, and then people who are putting together their vision for their wedding. How are you communicating about the differences in flower quality and why these flowers are more expensive? Because I do think there's a lot of confusion about how globalized the flower industry really is, how dirty some of the global flower industry can really be, and not trying to point fingers, but I think we have a romantic view of sniffing a rose, not thinking about all the herbicides that are likely on that rose. So I'd love to hear what you highlight for your clients who are trying to both stay on a budget, but also work with small farms and why that matters.
I don't think I knew right at the beginning how much education would be involved in this work. We probably spend as much time educating as we do designing. We are constantly in all modes, whether that is in person at our shop, on social media, in our newsletters, in person with clients, constantly talking about why local flowers, why it's important to support local growers, and why that price is higher. So, you know, the things that we talk about are growers in our community paying a living wage to their workers. We talk about land prices and land access and how difficult it is, unlike in some places, in other flower exporting countries where land may be cheap or easier to get, especially in Maryland. We are in some of the most expensive counties in the country. Land is very expensive. So these are growers that are keeping land out of development, so continuing on a farming tradition. They're paying workers, you know, a living wage. The majority of our growers, while not certified, are growing sustainably, organically, regeneratively, and there is cost to that. So we go through all of those pieces. We also, on the flip side, sort of explain why flowers being imported are so cheap. You know, that's because people are not getting paid a living wage. That's because land is cheaper. That's because there are not as many as environmental and worker laws that protect people that make the cogs not as expensive. So we go through all of that. And it's never just like, let's sit down and I'm going to give you my spiel about local flowers. It is a constant sort of peppering of information so that when people find us for a wedding or for anything else, they have a sense of who we are already and what we are about. And then we do a lot of some pre-education before you even come in for a consultation. So if you are not right for us or we are not right for you, there's no problem not coming in. We don't want to waste your time. We don't want to have our time wasted. So we really just go through a series of questions to get a sense of, do you understand how this process works? And the process really is, you're not going to know what you're getting for your wedding until I show up at the wedding. Like, that is the process. You can choose your general color palette. You can tell me things you like, but I am going to work with the growers to find the things that are seasonal, locally available, and fit within your look. And that's what I'm going to bring you. So if you're not okay with that, I always say, that's fine. There are a million other florists who will do other things for you. So if you're not fine with it, no worry. I'll give you a list of people you can call. And if you are good with that, then yeah, come on in. There's no pressure. I'm never trying to convince somebody they should use us because local is better, or we've been through many years of trying that. And for the most part, that doesn't work as well. So we really just want everybody to be in the relationship of their own will and their own interests and their own excitement and kind of go from there.
I love what you're saying, Ellen. And I wish more people, whether it was a wedding or a birthday party or an anniversary, to choose a floral designer based on their ability to design and let them work with what's seasonally available. My husband's an architect. it's not the same where he has a client who thinks that they know exactly how they want the thing to look. There's often precedent imagery and a lot of inspiration, of course, but when you sign up to work with an architect, you're also working with someone who has their own portfolio. And to be able to say to a floral designer in particular, I'd want the freshest, most abundant and beautiful local blooms, work your magic. There's so much potential there. And I love hearing that that's the only way that you operate.
But you know what? That has taken a long time, not just to build up a relationship with our community where people feel like they can trust me to do that, but also in the beginning, having to get really comfortable with saying no to people. So in the beginning, I feel like a lot of people, when they're in business, you're like, I have to take every job. I'm like so hungry and I have to never say no to work for a lot of reasons. But for one, in our work, this is seasonal work. So it's like feast or famine. So we never want to turn down work when it comes to us. But what I have found and what it took me a long time to figure out, I think, was that every time I said yes to somebody who didn't care about local flowers or who didn't care about the process or who didn't feel comfortable with me as a floral designer, it was in those situations where we had problems. And so while it was hard to say no or to say this isn't a good fit, it totally made our business work the way we needed it to work. Because otherwise we would have just kept spinning our wheels with customers and clients that were not right for us. And the worst thing is that if you're a couple getting married and you're not comfortable with me or the process or not knowing what the flowers are going to be, and you're feeling stressed leading up to your wedding because you don't know what the flowers are going to be, that's like my worst nightmare, that something I am doing is causing you stress before your wedding. I always say the flowers should be the easy thing that you don't have to think about anymore. Like, you've booked us. We are going to do something amazing and beautiful, and you're going to love it. And I feel confident that I can say that. I don't want to do anything that causes people stress. So when people are not a good fit, I feel like that's where like stress comes in. So I've just had to like really teach myself and get really comfortable saying no to people. Now I feel much more comfortable with it, like after many years of doing it. But in the beginning, it does feel like you're just throwing money away. I'm so desperate to get this business going. Seems crazy to turn work away, but I think for us, it was just really the right call.
Such an important growth arc, I think, in every business, maturing into knowing who you are and being okay with the fact that no business is perfect for everyone. And there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
That's actually, it makes you better able.
Yes.
Yeah. And empowers you to serve the right customers. I wanted to ask before, because I have more questions about the entrepreneurship side of your journey. But before we get there, I also wanted to ask about some of the relationships with growers in this dynamic of, I work with what's fresh. I coordinate with the growers that are local doing work that I care about. As I told you before our call, I'm from Baltimore. My mother lives in Talbot County, Maryland. I remember, what was it, 3 or 4 years ago, where you just had the rainiest summer of all time and hoop houses were flooding and it was like madness. I mean, when you're working in this industry and you're committed to really only using the flowers that are locally available, how are you structuring your relationships with growers so that you can be an advocate, even in crazy torrential downpours, et cetera? Like, what does that look like for you?
Yeah. When I started the business, I had 3 farmers that I bought from, and they were all field growers. So growers that grew May to October. And outside of that, they didn't have anything. And so when I started the business, I did too. I offered work between May and October, because that's when the growers that I knew had flowers. After doing that for maybe a year or two, I thought, well, I really like this and I really want to do it more, but I can't survive on 3 growers who have all the same kind of flowers during the same kind of season. So I reached out to one of our first growers, John McEwen from Locust Point Flowers, and I asked him, you know, are there more growers somewhere? I don't know, like, how do I find more growers? And this was like pretty early on, like first, maybe after my first year. So first he told me about the ASCFG, which I joined pretty quickly. And that's the National Organization for Cut Flower Growers. And so, you know, they have a membership list. And so I sort of went through that and found people in our region. But then John also told me that it was something called the Maryland Cut Flower Growers Association, which was a group of growers who got together three times a year, November, January, and February, in person in Annapolis at the Ag Center, and then a couple times during the summer, maybe for tours. And he said, well, you could come. No non-farmer ever came, but sure, you could come. I remember walking into this meeting at the Ag Center, and there were like 40 farmers there. Even now, today, I like feel like I might start crying because I was like, could not believe that there were so many flower farmers. And these are not vegetable farmers who did flowers on the side. These are professional flower farmers. And I just knew this business was possible. Like that made me, even before he had even talked to these people, I just knew if there were this many people, there must be somebody who grows in the winter. There must be somebody who grows in a greenhouse. There must be somebody close to me. I just figured, and sure enough, there were. And so I spent maybe 5 years building relationships with this core group of maybe 15 farmers. So in the beginning, that meant, you know, inviting myself to their farm, learning about their business, working on their farm for a day, buying from them as consistently as I could so that I could prove to them that I was serious. And I always think of this story, Dave Dowling, who was a farmer here in Maryland and was the Association of Specially Cut Flower Growers president. He now works for Ball. He was one of these growers from this group. And I would go down to his farm every week. I would drive down an hour away. I had a full-time job, but I would either go before work or after work, and I would buy flowers from him. And he would say, okay, what I have available today is these two buckets of flowers. And I would be like, this is an entire farm full of flowers. Like there's greenhouses. Why are there these only two buckets for me? He didn't really indicate why, but I could tell it was sort of a test. And I kept coming back and I kept coming back. And finally, after like a year, he was like, okay, you're serious. You have staying power. These other flowers, I sort of reserve for my good regular customers. Now you're a good regular customer. And so I just spent years sort of building these kind of relationships where farmers could trust that this was not a passing fad for me, that I wasn't going to start sourcing from a wholesaler, you know, when they didn't have stuff. I just really proved to them that I was serious and that I was committed and that this was a long-term. And I always had in my head that this was a long-term plan. Like I always had the long game in mind, where I think a lot of people, especially new farmers today that I meet, often think like that these relationships are supposed to come together very quickly, and they just really don't. I'm still like 16 years in, still nurturing these relationships so that I can be sure to have flowers during a hurricane, flowers during a blizzard, flowers during a heat wave. I have now 50 growers that I can buy from, who all have different growing schedules. Some grow only in the winter. Some grow only in the summer. Some grow only indoors. Some grow only outdoors. I have sort of built this panel of growers who can make my customers feel confident that at any time of the year, no matter the weather, we will have local flowers for them. And in 16 years, I always have a blurb in my contract. If something happens and I have to buy from a wholesaler, I will. It's not like you're not going to get flowers. I'm not going to cancel. I'm going to get flowers wherever, the grocery store, if I have to. We've never had to do that. We've never once in all of our weather situations here, we've never had to buy outside of our local community in 16 years. And so, yeah, it's been really great. Our growers are great.
It's amazing. And it's such a wonderful, rich part of the country for growing. So I'm not surprised that you have just incredible farmers doing great work, finding their niche and growing exceptional flowers. As I listen to you speak, all I can think about is as we, as growers and designers, restaurants carrying local food products, et cetera, as we try and build these alternative economies that are localized, there's so much that has to be built from the ground up. As you were speaking, Ellen, all I could
think about was how your spreadsheets must look and how you must be navigating. And, you know, it sounds humorous. You mentioned Ball with Dave Dowling. For those who don't know, Ball is a humongous company that sells seeds and bulbs and plugs and start. When you purchase from an organization of that size, they have people in-house creating these logistical systems. When you are working one-to-one with a small-scale farm, be it an acre or even 20 or 30 acres, the likelihood that there's going to be this oiled logistical machine that can plug into a small-scale floristry, slim to none, right? Slim to none.
Slim to none.
So you had to create all of this yourself.
Yes.
In the trenches.
Right. I always say that we had to build our supply chain from zero. So where a traditional florist who sources from a wholesaler, who sources from South America, those systems are all in place. They've been in place for decades. For us, we basically said, okay, we're going to try this new thing. There are no online stores for local flowers. I mean, today there are, but 15 years ago there weren't. I mean, people didn't even have availability lists. They were just growers who either went to market or, like, a lot of our growers came up as we came up. They were people who were doing vegetables. And the more I talked about flowers, the more they grew flowers, the more we talked, the more they liked flowers, sort of came up with us. And so we really have had to build that entire supply chain from nothing. And unfortunate that I think has to be recreated, sure, in food, in textiles, in all of the other local products that we hope to buy in a community. There just are no big systems to manage that. I think now, today, there's more flower co-ops. There's more online ordering. So there have been, I think, some movement in that, but it is still very new. It's still very in the beginning stages. And it's still not easy to purchase these flowers, right? Like, it is not easy for most florists, certainly, and a lot of customers to even know how to go about buying local flowers. And right, we've had to build that. And we've also had to try to figure out a system where other florists can figure out how to do it. Because if our growers are sort of increasing their yield so that we can buy more flowers for them, they also need to sell to more florists. And if florists are like, I don't know how to do this. I mean, I created an entire 20-hour online course to help florists learn how to source locally because we were so committed to our growers. And it was never like, oh, it's just our thing. Like, it's just this special thing that we can do. We wanted all florists to be able to do that. And teaching them how to do that seemed like the best way forward.
This episode of The Soft Focus is brought to you by Late Bloomer Ranch, my farm and ranch in eastern Idaho, where we raise meat, eggs, wool, and cut flowers of the utmost quality with integrity to match. You can hear more about the ranch, our practices, and the why behind our premium products in episode 10 of this podcast with ranch manager Eliana Arujo. We now ship flower essences from our flower garden, perfect for altering your auric field and impacting the subtle body, yarn from our registered flock of Leicester Longwool sheep for all your knitting, crocheting, and fiber arts, and our signature bloom boxes, chock full of our truly exceptional meat to stock your freezer with the best of the best. We ship all over the continental United States. Supporting Late Bloomer Ranch is supporting the Soft Focus podcast, and we are so glad you're here. Check us out on latebloomerranch.com and on Instagram at Late Bloomer Ranch. Now, back to the episode.
I love what you're saying. A rising tide raises all boats. And earlier you mentioned how so many of these relationships are about the long game. It's about learning how to work within the structure. And for us, you know, connecting with some of the florists that we work with, I would love to be able to sit down with them for a day in the winter and learn more about the back end of their business and what they need, because it is really hard to just anticipate the other parties' needs and wants and what makes certain vendors more appealing than others. You know, what small changes can we make in our availability list or in our communications or in our delivery schedule that would move the needle on making the relationship really work? So I think that's really cool.
Those winter meetings, I think, are key. Like, we have always tried to do winter meetings with our growers, But even this year, particularly, we have a grower here in Baltimore City, Hill and Homestead. And Maya just said to me this year, I finally, after 10 years, feel like I've got the right questions to ask the florists so that I know now more about how their business works. Because the more the farmer knows about how a florist business works, the better able you are to serve them, right? If you know that they're closed on Monday and Tuesday, they're jammed up on Wednesday, and then they're doing weddings on Thursday and Friday, you know that they don't need flowers on Monday because they are not open. The more you know, the better able you are to serve them. And that's the goal.
It's awesome. I love that you're developing these communication strategies and then teaching other florists about what you've done. I did want to ask you about being an entrepreneur, a woman with a vision. You started with this vision. You even used the term naive. I really related to that. I think if I had known how hard farming really was when I started 15 years ago, I would never would have done it. But what have been your biggest learning curves, the moments where you wanted to quit and then you felt like, no, I'm going to figure this out because I honestly care?
I think for me, I was learning about flowers. I had to actually learn what the names of flowers were. I had to learn what the harvest stage was. I had to learn how they worked in arrangements. I had to learn arranging. I didn't know how to do flower arranging. So that was just like the hands-on kind of work of it. I went to business school sort of right before I started this business. I got an MBA. I took some entrepreneurship classes. I had never thought about doing a business before. I had always thought, well, I'll run a nonprofit, or like that was kind of my thinking in going to business school. But it wasn't until I took an entrepreneurship class that I thought, wait a minute, maybe I could take this hobby and turn this into something that could help my community. So I had sort of like some foundational business knowledge, but I had certainly never like put it into action, right? I had sort of studied it in school. So when I started the business, one of, I think, the most challenging things for me was that understanding that growth is like the norm in a small business. Like you're just growing, growing, growing. You're taking all the work you can. You're adding staff. You're adding vehicles. You're adding, and that in some way, that's the goal, like to continue to grow. And I would say maybe like 8 or 9 years into the business, what I found was that I had taken on too many jobs, too much staff. I was exhausted. I was not making enough money. And part of that was that I just kept saying yes to bigger things and more weddings. And what I was not fully understanding was that as we increased those things, you know, all of our expenses increased too. And so at the end of that year, I think it was year 8, looking at sort of our profit and loss statement at the end of the year, I was like, how is it that we did all of that work for so little money? How is that possible? We were more profitable 4 years ago when we were only doing one wedding a weekend, when we were doing one event a week. Now that we're doing 3 weddings a weekend with 3 different teams and different vehicles, we're actually not as profitable. So for me, I was like, it really took like almost like a full year to wrap my head around that and to say, okay, I think we have to like step back a little bit. Like we have to reduce the number of weddings we're doing. We have to reduce our staff costs. We have to find the right clients, you know, sort of that same thinking. What we did, you know, we sort of said, okay, geographically, we'll do less weddings. We're only going to do 2 weddings a weekend. We're not going to have multiple teams out there. Like it's either me and my husband and a helper. And if we can't do it, then that's not the kind of wedding we need. And after maybe 2 years, we were back to being more profitable. There's just like nobody out there that says you don't have to continue to grow just for growth's sake. You don't have to continue to keep getting bigger because bigger isn't better necessarily. What is important is like doing work you love for us, working with clients that we like, with growers that we like, being able to make a living doing it and not being so tired and burned out that we just couldn't enjoy our lives. And so for me, I think that year 8 to year 10 was really sort of a changing point for us.
Did you feel like you were letting go of a previous version of your business or like releasing part of your dream?
I thought more like, I wish somebody had told me that I could just stay where I was at year six and do that for another 10 years at that size and that shape and that scope. Because we were still serving clients, we were still serving our community, we were still having fun, we were still doing all of those things. But I just didn't see any model of that in the world. I just didn't hear, certainly at business school, they're not telling you that. And certainly, you know, I didn't have sort of a business community here that was telling me that. So I feel like it was actually the opposite. Like I felt like the dream was going up to year six. And then once we started really like loading ourselves up with more and more and more work, that was when I was like, this is not the dream. This has just become a job that feels very stressful and very overwhelming. And what I want to do is not feel like this. I want to feel like I did a couple of years ago. And so cutting back, I mean, it's hard to say no to people in that way, to say like, we're booked for the year, or we're not doing weddings on the Eastern Shore, or we're not going to DC anymore. We're not going to Frederick anymore. Those were hard things to say, but I feel like in the end, it really allowed us to even do more of what we enjoyed and what we loved.
And that's probably what created the space for you to do all the cool educational stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you referenced that earlier, that you started a 20-hour course for florists to teach them how to work with local growers in their area. Was that where that started? Was that your first foray into the educational sphere? That's one of my favorite things about your business, is just how much of it is education-based.
I did a lot of it in the shop, like locally. Ever since we bought our building, which I think has been 10 or 11 years ago now, we have offered in-person design classes. We have a flower book club. We have special, what we call flower club events, which are community events like flower trivia night or a mystery design night. Like we have a lot of in-person stuff, but I was really interested in trying to expand the reach of what I had learned. That was when the idea of like doing an online class sort of came about. I've created two online classes. They both are offered through the Gardener's Workshop, through Lisa Mason Ziegler, who is, you know, a joy in the world just for every flower farmer. So the two classes that she invited me in to work with her and her team and offer the classes on her platform. So we've done that over the last couple of years. It's been great because it has allowed me to reach an audience that I wouldn't otherwise have been able to reach. We always laugh because so much of what we do is so hyper-local. That's never been an issue. It's always, that's been our focus, like Baltimore growers, Baltimore customers, like everything has been very hyper-local. So when we started to think about an expanded reach, I was like, wow, I don't know how to find people outside of Baltimore. Like we are connected through the ASCFG, which is has been a great sort of community nationally. But certainly working with the Gardener's Workshop, I think, expanded our reach a lot more than I could ever have imagined. It's been a great relationship. So yeah, I have two classes there. One is for florists. It's called Growing Your Business with Local Flower Sourcing. And the second one is for farmers, actually, called Preparing to Sell to Florists, which is just a little mini course that is like 90 minutes on how to like get ready to approach a florist if you want to sell to them. So both of those options have been really fun. And I've got to meet lots of people throughout over the country. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
And you have all kinds of videos on your site. And I think it's really interesting in context of what you were saying before, that you had to release this idea of getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But in some ways, you have gotten bigger. You've just gotten bigger in a way that made sense with your original vision and your personal skills. I mean, you're so warm and intelligent. You put so much effort into building the business over the last 16 years. So it makes sense that the growth is in the direction of sharing those skills instead of seeing it in that one-dimensional way.
I'm also getting older. right? So if I'm being honest, part of this journey has been, how can I continue to do the work that I love as I age? As I'm 51 now, I can't, like, it's harder and harder to stand on a ladder for 3 hours or to stand at the shop designing for 12 hours straight. Or, you know, like, I've just had to start thinking about those things in real terms. So, like, one of those plans is like, okay, let's start, you know, doing more YouTube videos. Let's start doing the newsletter. Let's start reaching out online to people to spread that message of local flowers in a way that just I haven't had time or opportunity to do before. And now it's starting to feel, maybe for the first time, the balance feels really right, where the in-person stuff here in Baltimore is at a place where I feel like comfortable physically and just like emotionally. And I get to try all these new things that introduce me to a whole new group of people. So I think I'm trying to find that balance.
Seems perfectly timed too, though. I love when that happens, when by trusting your intuition, trusting, oh, my life is changing. I'm, for instance, pregnant right now. So when I think about with my second child and when I think about how my business is going to grow, that's of course a factor. And instead of looking at that as a drawback, I always try and see it as an asset or an edge, because of course you investing in yourself as an educator has coincided with this boom in cut flower producers and farmer florists and other florists trying to follow in your footsteps. I mean, how have you seen the flower industry change over the last, let's say, 5 years? And where do you see it going?
I feel like the changes are so exciting. It is like so thrilling to see, like when I started, you know, 16 years ago, think there was like no social media. There was email and there were blogs. That was pretty much it. And that was how I met Jenny, because she had a blog and I reached out to her. But that was like the only way that flower people sort of connected. There was so different and it felt so isolated. And it felt like we were just out here on our own, like trying to figure this out, like just really like from nothing. And now I feel like there are so many opportunities for people across the country, across the world to connect and learn and to see so much interest in local flowers, not just for weddings, not just for single orders, not just in restaurants, but like just so much interest in local flowers from regular people, from like regular consumers and hobbyists. And it's thrilling. It's really amazing. And I do see it just continuing. I think certainly younger people are more cognizant of how their buying habits impact the earth, their communities. That's really exciting, because I do feel like younger people are making maybe more conscious decisions than some other folks are. So I think that's really exciting. I also think it's like great that like people that are 50 years old think that they can just start flower farming and have another business. It's amazing. It is amazing to me how you're familiar with like the sort of cycle of what happened to flower farmers in our country, you know, during the 80s and 90s, and how imports really decimated local flower farmers and how imports changed how consumers bought, and to see the trend changing. And of course, there will always be imports. I'm not saying like that we're going to go back to a time when everything was locally sourced, but to see more interest and more, not just interest. One of the things I think is very exciting to me is seeing florists like Shane Connolly, who is the royal florist. He was the Queen's florist. He's King Charles's florist. For him to be out in the world elevating local flowers, sustainability, foam-free designs, it is like seeing yourself reflected in this worldview that you were like, I never thought I would see somebody, the king's coronation or the queen's funeral, talking about local flowers. Like, it's amazing to me to feel part of that sort of growing interest. So I think it's just going to continue. I think there is just a really bright future for local flowers out there.
I love it. And I think the average person can experience the difference. As a vendor and as someone who, we have a small flower subscription, people really do have a first time experiential change when they're like, wow, these are vibrant flowers. the colors, just the way that they feel in your home is so different than something that was picked 2 weeks ago and is covered in formaldehyde or who knows what. And like you said, the foam and the plastics, and it just kind of, it all distills into this very almost rarefied experience. Or you can bring in a little slice of your local region that feels so much more invigorating and people sense it.
Totally. And has a story with it, and it connects you. Like, isn't every news story about like how lonely people are and how disconnected people are? And to be able to connect to an actual person who grew that flower and to know that land where that flower was grown is just a beautiful thing. It is something that our customers, I know, feel when they buy flowers from us. I know because I hear them telling their friends, oh, did you know that this guy, John, he's the only person who grows these kind of flowers. They're like saying the things I've told them. They care about it. It's impactful. And I think there is a real difference that people can sense when they have local flowers.
I love it. Okay, I have to ask kind of a corny question, but what are your three favorite must be local, would never buy from a wholesaler flowers?
Dahlias, for sure. Dahlias just, you know, they are just really not great at the wholesaler. They're really, really bad. So dahlias for sure. I think poppies are so delicate. And then a flower that I don't use a ton and love a ton, I like them. Zinnias don't ship. So the zinnias that you see at the wholesaler came from somewhere not shipped, but still from far away. And they just always look the worst, like the worst. And local zinnias, I feel like, are so beautiful. And they just are such high quality, especially from like flower farmers. And so those, for sure, I would say, seek those out, because you just will not get anything comparable from a wholesaler.
Love it. Okay, last question. What do you have going on? Where can people connect with you? Tell me about your newsletter.
All of my normal things at work, like in person. And then I do have a free weekly newsletter, which I have to say I'm super proud of. Like, I am not a person who is good with consistency. However, I have written and published a weekly newsletter every Thursday for over 1 year, and it is full of flower stories about growers and growing flowers and designing flowers and flower adventures. And it's basically like my life in flowers, but in a newsletter. And it is really fun to write. And we've had such great feedback from it. People are just like, I don't know, it's been really fun. So I've also been making weekly YouTube videos, which are also fun, but different because, you know, YouTube is a different thing. But lots of good, I think, content on there about designing and using local flowers, because local flowers really are different. You know, they work different in design, and a lot of people maybe just have not experienced that. So a lot of hands-on showing people how local flowers work in designs. So weekly newsletter, weekly YouTube, and maybe some things coming soon that still in the works. So I think in the next year, you'll see hopefully some more ways that our flower community can connect to each other. So if anybody's interested in signing up for the newsletter, I think that's the best way to learn more, but also just to get more educated. I love helping people feel like expert at flowers. I want people to like go out and tell other people flower stories. And the newsletter, I feel like, is a good way to do that.
Yes, I'm a recipient of your weekly emails, and they're great. I can attest. And, you know, there's some really fun information, you know, things that the average person may not think about, like how to get the best vase life out of different blooms and different storage techniques and all these things that are actually highly critical to producing high quality blooms on your table, but maybe aren't the first thing that someone's thinking about when they're out in their garden. So,
absolutely.
I'll link it in the show notes, but is it localcolorflowers.com?
You can find me at just ellenfrost.com. So that's the easiest way. And the shop is locoflow.com. So either of those, you can find us at either.
Okay, I'll link both of them. Thank you so much, Ellen. This has been so fun.
It was so great talking with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I really hope you enjoyed this episode. Please reach out with any comments or with other guests you'd like to hear. You can find us at latebloomerranch.com or on Instagram at latebloomerranch. You can also drop me an email at hello@latebloomerranch.com. I'd love to hear from you. See you next time.